he muttered. Lady Tiverton gave him a gentle smile. Sir Leicester continued.
His given name is Horace, but thanks to his work in Egyptology, my first wife gave him the nickname Horus, after the god king. It amused him.
He shook his head, his expression suddenly mulish.
For more than a decade we dug together, but at the end of last season I told him I would not partner with him again, and he took it badly. He made a scene in Shepherd's, threatened me with a pistol,
he said in a tone of indignation.
Americans and their guns,
he muttered. Did you tell him about the tomb you discovered? I asked mildly. The baronet flushed deeply.
I did not. Horace always ridiculed my idea of anything of value being concealed in the wadis in that part of the valley. He thought it a waste of time to poke about, looking for a find. But I was right,
he added stubbornly.
We were discussing where to dig this year when he began nettling me about my ideas. Well, why should I tell him the truth when he was forever carping about my lack of scholarship, my flights of fancy? I did not want to share it with him. I wanted to dig it all up myself and then force him to acknowledge that he was wrong. So I simply told him I refused to continue the partnership.
He shifted uncomfortably in his chair.
I would not give him a reason, and that is what angered him more than anything.
And he was back in the valley digging this season?
Stoker asked.
He chose to dig at Amarna instead,
Mr. Fairbrother corrected.
Quite a distance from our location in the valley, but Mr. Steele visited other friends in the area often. It made things rather awkward.
I can imagine. But I have seen Mr. Steele's photograph in the newspapers,
Stoker countered.
He is a gentleman of advanced years. I cannot imagine him putting on the guise of Anubis and gambling about the desert.
Have you seen a photograph of his son?
Fairbrother asked.
Henry Steele could do a fair impression of an Egyptian god, I would wager.
Lady Tiverton shook her head.
It is too terrible. They were our friends. It is impossible.
I offered her a thin smile.
What was it that Napoleon said, my lady?
Impossible is a word only to be found in the dictionary of fools.
Amen,
said Patrick Fairbrother, raising his teacup in a toast. We took our leave of the Tibetans, emerging from the warm elegance of the Sudbury lobby into the darkening street. Splinters of ice shone in the glow of the street lamps, and all around us London hurried on its way, bustling through the late afternoon gloom.
All right, I told Stoker, as I tucked the edge of my glove under my cuff. I could feel you rumbling like a volcano in there. You did a masterful job of holding your temper, but there's no need now. Rant.
His jaw was set in a hard line.
It's that disgraceful business with the mummy. They mean to put her on display.
Her sarcophagus only, I corrected.
That sarcophagus is the mummy case, the inner lining of her coffin,
he countered.
There would have been at least two more surrounding it, and a shrine to hold the whole of it. Displaying the sarcophagus is like letting the rabble into Windsor to see the Queen in her nightdress.
I ignored the reference to my grandmother and strove to grasp his point.
Such entertainments have been fashionable for decades, I pointed out.
Entertainments?
He turned squarely to face me, the light from the nearest street lamp throwing his face into sharp relief.
She was a person, for God's sake. She deserves to be left in peace, not displayed like a fairground attraction for people with half a shilling to gawp at.
5 guineas, I corrected.
I don't care if they charge 1,000 guineas and the Koh-i-Noor, it's wrong.
You are a scientist, I reminded him, Surely you appreciate the discoveries which may be made from examination of the princess.
Examination, yes. By properly trained scholars under suitably respectful circumstances. This is nothing more than a carnival show. A bit of theatrical nonsense to line Sir Leicester Tiverton's pockets. The man is no better than Barnum, hawking his freaks to anyone with the price of admission.
A nutseller uncovered his brazier, setting out a pan to roast chestnuts, while a passing boy jostled me a little, muttering an apology with a tug of his low tweed cap. Stoker put a hand under my elbow and guided me to the side of the pavement. I said nothing for a long moment, waiting for him to speak again.
"She was human once,"
he said finally.
"She walked and breathed and loved people, and she had a name. Anquesset. It will be inscribed on the heart scarab that someone laid upon her to protect her in the afterlife. That ought to be respected, instead of letting the rabble in to paw at her. She deserves to rest in peace."
I lifted a brow. "Stoker, what a dreadful romantic you are." He opened his mouth, but I held up a hand. "I happen to agree with you. There is something highly distasteful about the notion of the princess being displayed for the amusement of passers-by." I grinned. "All the more reason to see if we can discover the whereabouts of John de Morgan and the princess's diadem. Perhaps if we return the jewel to Sir Leicester, he would be grateful enough to listen to a little persuasion upon the subject." Stoker thought for a moment, then suddenly took my hand.
"Come on. There is someone you ought to meet."
He guided me around the corner to the staff entrance of the hotel. Tearing a leaf from his pocket notebook, he scribbled a hasty note and thrust it into the hands of a waiting errand boy with a small coin.
"Take that to Monsieur Durland,"
he instructed. We waited a few minutes, stamping our feet against the chill. Suddenly the door opened, and out rolled a warm wave of air perfumed with cinnamon and yeast and roasted meats. A man in a pristine double-breasted white coat emerged. Atop his head perched a rakish scarlet velvet beret, and he wore a slender gold signet ring upon his smallest finger.
"Revelstoke!" he called in obvious delight,
his face wreathed in smiles. Stoker grinned, and the two men embraced, clapping one another hard upon the back.
"Veronica, this is Julien Durland. Julien, this is Miss Speedwell."
The fellow was perhaps Stoker's age, with long, slender hands and skin the rich silken brown of Nymphalis antiopa, the Camberwell beauty butterfly. He offered me a broad smile.
"Mademoiselle Speedwell."
His voice carried the soft seduction of a French accent, and his dark eyes were expressive. Comprehension dawned.
"You're Lady Welly's pastry chef."
Lady Welly had told me once of finding a post for a French protégé as the pastry chef at the Sudbury, and I was delighted to make his acquaintance.
"I am indeed,"
he acknowledged.
"But, Revelstoke, shame on you for keeping a lady standing in the cold. You have the manners of a Corsican peasant,"
he added, with a quick grin at Stoker. He beckoned to me.
"Come into my office, where it is warm."
He escorted us inside the hotel, and it was like seeing the inner workings of a beautiful clock. So many moving pieces, so much technical chaos. And yet the front presented only a serene and orderly facade. Here, endless rooms formed a labyrinthine arrangement, each space devoted to a separate task. Preparing sauces, roasting meats, baking bread. Monsieur Durland explained that his responsibility was overseeing the fine pastry, the delicate confections that graced the dinner tables in the dining salon above. The simple cakes and muffins we had enjoyed at tea were prepared by his underlings, but I could see he kept a careful eye upon them as we passed through. He glanced from side to side, offering a criticism here and praise there. One young man was teasing honey ice cream from a beehive mold, while another spun sugar into a gilded cloud to form a nest.
"Forêt croque-mouche,"
Monsieur told me as I gaped.
"It is our speciality."
"It is magnificent," I said, breathing in the aromas of cooked sugar and vanilla. Stoker gazed longingly at a pyramid of tiny puffs of dough that had been fried quickly and stuffed with sweet cream and dusted with sugar. Courteous people called them beignets soufflé, but I had also heard them called by the rather earthier epithet of pays de nun, or nun's farts. Either way, the sight of their golden seductions had reduced Stoker to a wordless whimper as we passed.
"I will send a box,"
Monsieur Durland promised.
"Pays de nun for you, Stoker, but I think langue de chat for the enchanting Miss Speedwell,"
he added, with a slow smile of Gallic appreciation. Cat's tongues, indeed. He showed us into a small office and closed the door behind. The air here was redolent of sugar and chocolate. There were a desk and an assortment of chairs, as well as an undraped window that overlooked the pastry kitchen, so he could keep a close watch upon his assistants at all times. The desk was tidy, but the bookshelf empty. "You have no cookbooks," I said, pointing to the empty shelf. He tapped his forehead with one slim finger.
"A book may be lost. A true master carries all the knowledge he requires here."
I smiled, and he brought a bottle of dark liquid from a cabinet. He retrieved a set of tiny stemmed glasses of thin crystal and poured a thimble full of the stuff for each of us.
"It is a dessert liqueur of my own invention. I flavor it with violets and hay."
It sounded like the most unpromising thing I had ever drunk, but I took a sip to be polite. Instantly, springtime burst into flower on my tongue. The hay tasted green and fresh, while the sensual violet blossomed darkly beneath. "Extraordinary," I proclaimed. He gave me a satisfied smile.
"I think it has promise."
Stoker said nothing but held out his glass with a hopeful look. Monsieur shook his head.
"No more. It is almost finished, and I have yet to perfect it. When I do, I will send you an entire bottle." "I shall hold you to that."
Monsieur Durland eased back in his chair, his manner expansive.
"I think you do not come here only for the samples. What service may I perform for you?"
It was a charmingly old-fashioned request, and I found myself appreciating his courtly ways. He was a Frenchman through and through, and I had always been susceptible to Gallic flourishes. Stoker came directly to the point.
"I need you to do a bit of spying."
Monsieur's brows lifted.
"Not my usual occupation, but for you I will be happy to try. Upon whom am I to spy?"
"The Tiverton party," I supplied.
"Plum cakes and plain custard,"
he said with a touch of disapproval.
"They like their puddings very English. Not for them the crisp leaves of the millefeuille, or the many satisfactions of a perfectly made Saint Honoré. No, Sir Leicester Tiverton always wants rice pudding with prunes."
He shuddered.
"But the young lady, she has promise. I am told she ate a second helping of my Turkish fantasia."
"Turkish fantasia?"
Stoker asked, fairly drooling. Monsieur shrugged.
"A new creation of mine, based upon an old Turkish recipe. Rosewater creme caramel, very delicate, finished with lacework of gilded sugar and a garnish of candied pistachios. The Turks are masters of the subtle uses of perfume in pastry, he added.
Stoker sighed a little as Monsieur went on.
Mademoiselle Tiverton was appreciative. I think she might be persuaded to an orange blossom tart,
he said, tipping his head thoughtfully.
I shall make for her a delicate mousse of the orange blossom, and glaze the bottom of the tart with bitter chocolate, and garnish it with whipped sweet cream and curls of chocolate.
Stoker gave a low moan of longing at the description. Monsieur smiled.
Naturally, as an employee of the hotel, it is forbidden for me to fraternize with the guests. But if I were to send such a delicacy to her, with the compliments of the kitchen, and an invitation to see how such a confection is created, she might feel compelled to accept.
She most certainly would, I agreed. I think the girl is lonely. I glanced out the window to where the two assistants were assembling the pastry puffs into a mountain with the sticky aid of strong caramel. Best to send the tart up with the dark-haired one. He is by far the better-looking. Monsieur gave a laugh, a rumbling sound that began low in his belly and worked its way up.
You are a lady of original thinking, Mademoiselle Speedwell. I suspect you have French blood.
I thought of the French princesses sprinkled throughout my father's family tree. Perhaps a bit, I murmured. Aren't you curious as to why we are asking you to spy upon this family? He shrugged.
I would never question Revelstoke, my dear mademoiselle,
he said simply.
I told him once whatever service I can render him, he has only to ask, and this is the first time he has done so.
Stoker reddened, a charming blush that warmed his complexion to the tips of his ears.
Rubbish,
he muttered.
But if you help us, I will consider it a personal favour.
Monsieur shook his hand.
I will send word to you as soon as I know anything of importance.
Shall we take a greeting to Lady Wellingtonia from you? I asked. He smiled, baring a set of gorgeous white teeth.
No need, dear lady. I dine with her once a fortnight,
he told me.
Lady Wellingtonia, like Stoker, never forgets her friends.
He bowed low over my hand.
It has been a pleasure to make your acquaintance, Mademoiselle Speedwell.
And yours, monsieur. Stoker gave a low growl.
If the pair of you are quite finished, he said, gesturing to the door.
I flashed Monsieur a parting smile, and he touched his fingertips to his lips in a gesture of farewell. We took our leave of the Sudbury and its scented delights, emerging into the darkening chill of the February gloom. Piles of dirty snow were heaped upon each curbstone, and the odour of manure and rotting vegetables hung heavy in the air. "London is an unlovely place in winter," I said with some vehemence. I would trade every smoking chimney, every grey fog, for one clear alpine peak. Stoker shuddered.
Never.
He elaborated on his dislike for mountains, but my mind was wandering, flitting away to a particular Swiss meadow where I had pursued a pretty little Parnassus Apollo and been, in my turn, pursued by my guide. I had given up the butterfly chase, surrendering instead to the pleasures of the flesh, and to this day the smell of spring grass brings back the tenderest memories. I had gone into that meadow an eager girl, and emerged from it, plucking crushed edelweiss from my hair and petticoats, a self-possessed and happily experienced woman.
"Are you even listening?"
Stoker was asking. "No," I replied with perfect candour. I was recalling my first taste of the erotic joys.
How on earth? Never mind. I ought to know better than to question the vagaries of your imagination.
Speaking of attractive men, I said, what a charming man Monsieur Durland is.
Yes, Julien does tend to have that effect,
Stoker said, in a tone as dry as the Sahara.
I have yet to meet a woman who doesn't find him enchanting. I don't know if it is the accent or the fact that he always smells like sugar.
They are both intoxicating qualities in a man, I informed him. I thought of the story Lady Wellingtonia had told of the first time she had encountered Monsieur Durland at the opening of the Royal Museum of Natural History. Was he really dressed in a loincloth when you met him? I asked. Stoker's handsome mouth turned down.
He was. The director of the museum thought he would make a suitable addition to the display of African apes.
I remembered Lady Wellingtonia's description of what followed. The fact that Stoker had thrashed the director with his bare fists had not surprised me. The fact that Julien Durland proved to be a qualified pastry chef did. How did he come to such a pass with all of his talents? Stoker shrugged.
It is not always easy for a black man to find employment, even one as talented as Julien. His family were from Martinique, accomplished chefs, all of them. His grandfather was trained by Carême, and his father cooked for Napoleon III. Julien was actually born at the palace at Fontainebleau. He trained as a pastry chef and went to work for a Parisian banker who decided to spend a winter in London, overseeing some investments. He brought Julien with him so he would dine well while he was here. As luck would have it, the fellow died suddenly, leaving neither cash to pay Julien's salary nor references. Julien spoke no English then and knew no one in London. He fell on hard times and took the job at the museum rather than face the workhouse.
I shook my head. He is obviously an aristocrat in the kitchen. It seems astonishing that he would take such demeaning employment.
Julien is, like all Frenchmen, eminently practical. He thought a few days of standing on display in a loincloth would be a small price to pay to earn the wages to get himself back to Paris.
He must be grateful that you intervened, I mused.
Grateful? He called me a horse's ass when I thrashed the museum director. We were both thrown out, and he never received the wages he had earned. I cost him a full day's pay. Do not make the mistake of thinking I rescued him, he warned. Julien Durland is the proverbial cat with nine lives. He would have landed quite nicely on his feet without my interference at all.
I tipped my head. Still, I wonder how many God-fearing Englishmen walked past him and saw what they wanted him to be rather than what he is.
What he is a bloody genius, he told me. And when he sends that box of pastries, I have no intention of sharing.
It was your idea to set him to watching the Tivitans, I reminded him. You have earned them. We walked on, taking in bracing lungfuls of cold London air, choking only a little on the smoke and fog that thickened it. Still, it was better than cooping ourselves up like chickens in the stuffy atmosphere of a cab, and we stretched our legs, weaving in and around the traffic, dodging the piled drifts of filthy snow. Aside from brisk laps in the Earl's bathing pool, it was the most exercise either of us had had for some weeks. I felt my mood rise with every step. I first became aware of the fact that we were being followed when we paused at the corner of Oxford Street. Here the traffic changed from the commercial vehicles and cabs to the sober respectability of private conveyances as we made our way into Marylebone. The teeming pavements gave way to casual walkers in good weather. In February, only the heartiest souls were afoot, I heard the brisk clip of footsteps behind us. Pausing to fuss with the lace of my boot, I noted the footsteps stopped. I darted a glance under my arm and saw a fellow of medium height, his cap pulled low over his brow. The same fellow who had jostled me outside the Sudbury. Instantly he stopped to inspect a railing, pursing his lips in a soundless whistle. His affected nonchalance did not deceive me. I noticed the rapidity of his respiration, white clouds puffing into the air as he attempted to catch his breath. Stoker and I were swift walkers. No one in his right mind would have tried to keep pace with us unless he were on the hunt and we were his prey. I stood up and gave Stoker a smile, looping my arm through his and pulling his head near mine. "We have a pursuer." To his credit, Stoker did not look behind. Instead, he cocked an ear.
30 feet behind," he murmured. "Perhaps 40.
His experience as a tracker stood us in good stead. Besides listening intently to gauge our followers' pace, Stoker occasionally flicked his eyes sideways when a large expanse of window glass reflected our quarry. We continued on our way, vigilant but with every appearance of nonchalance. We paced the length of the street until at last we came to the corner that marked the boundary of Bishop's Folly. Without discussion, we turned the corner and plunged instantly into the shrubbery, forcing our way through a modest break in the foliage. We crouched on the other side, waiting, peering through the leaves of the evergreens for our pursuer. The fellow rounded the corner at a brisk trot, no doubt fully winded by now, exhaling in great gusts. He pulled up sharply at seeing an empty street. He stopped, open-mouthed in astonishment, turning his head from side to side. The hole in the shrubbery was quite low, and it was nearly impossible to find unless one knew to look for it. Our pursuer did not. He stood, his face in deep shadow, turning in a slow circle to make certain he was entirely alone. As soon as his back was turned, Stoker launched himself through the shrubbery. I was hard upon his heels, issuing a fair impression of a Maori battle cry, while Stoker preferred to attack in a rush of menacing silence. He seized the villain by the throat and lifted him clear off his feet. The booted feet fluttered for a moment, then one snapped forwards, connecting with a rather delicate part of Stoker's anatomy with a vigor I could only admire. Stoker gasped and opened his fist, dropping the fellow to the ground, where he landed hard upon his posterior. "Bollocking hell!" the villain exclaimed. In the moment of shocked surprise that followed, the blackguard leapt up and charged down the street. Stoker was in no fit state to follow, but I gave chase, pounding the pavement as I ran. I am, as anyone who has met me can attest, accounted fleet of foot. But I was hampered upon this occasion by my sex, dear reader. Could I have overtaken our miscreant and emerged the victor in our little foot race? Certainly, were it not for one fact. I was wearing a dress. Garbed for a polite social call at tea time, I was harnessed and corseted and knotted into submission. Even the dainty heels of my boots, so fashionable when glimpsed from under the froth of my petticoat, hindered me. My prey eluded me by the simple expedient of trousers and flat boots, taking the opportunity to jump onto the back of a passing hansom and trot smartly away as I stood watching in impotent fury. I returned to where I had left Stoker and found him gingerly attempting to stand upright, his mouth set in a grim line. He did not have to ask. My expression told him that I had been unsuccessful.
"Well, that's an unexpected development," Stoker said mildly. "I thought you were the only woman in London who wore trousers."
Chapter 7. I rose the next day in a state of decided satisfaction.
We had scarcely begun our investigation into John de Morgan's disappearance, but we had clearly agitated someone if we were being followed. And to what purpose? Our shadowy female friend could hardly have intended violence. She had been obviously unprepared for any sort of physical confrontation. Her surprise at Stoker's attack and her instinct to flight spoke to a lack of experience. The fact that she had temporarily incapacitated Stoker before taking to her heels was the rankest luck. Hitching herself onto a passing hansom had been a telling move. It revealed her as being audacious and opportunistic, but we might have guessed those things by the simple act of a young woman assuming male guise to follow us. The question was, why? Was she an agent of Caroline de Morgan, intent upon discovering the whereabouts of an errant husband? Was she a private detective, secretly engaged by Sir Leicester to recover his priceless diadem? Curiosity seeker? Subordinate of Sir Hugo Montgomery, sent to keep a weather eye upon us? I considered the possibilities as I made my way to the glasshouse. The heating now regulated, it was a lush paradise, the air thick with the green scent of leaves slowly unfurling themselves from slumber. In one corner, a little apart from the warmer regions of the glasshouse, sat a tiny copse of potted hornbeams. Nestled amidst the leaves were a series of papery cocoons, bronze-brown and wrinkled like decaying nuts, all about the length of my thumb. Each was frilled with a bit of hornbeam leaf, the last meal of the bright green caterpillars before they spun the enclosure that would shelter their metamorphoses. The caterpillars, and their costly hornbeam perches, had been a gift from Stoker's eldest brother, the Viscount Templeton Vane. They had arrived most unexpectedly with a note inviting me to the opera and signed, affectionately, Tiberius. I had refused the invitation, but Stoker's order to return the caterpillars to his brother had caused me to nurture them as if they were my own children. I had always scorned moths, but I had to admit that in their larval form they had been winsome little fellows and provided me with a great deal of unexpected amusement. I had fallen into the habit of visiting them on a daily basis, eagerly awaiting the moment they would eclose and step onto the branches, damp-winged and trembling. "Actius Luna," I murmured. "Good morning to you all."
"Are you talking to the trees, miss?"
George asked, emerging from the misty reaches of the glasshouse.
"Indeed not. I was greeting my collection of cocoons, George."
I pointed to the little colony.
"These are specimens of Actius Luna, the lunar moth. When they emerge, they will be pale green moths as big as Mr. Stoker's hand."
I spread my hands to indicate the size of a fully grown imago, and George's eyes widened.
"Do they bite?" he asked warily.
Like most city children, he had an unhealthy fear of nature. I suppressed a sigh.
"They do not. Actius Luna, in its adult form, has no mouth." "How does it eat?"
"It doesn't," I informed him. "It only lives a week, and its purpose is purely procreative."
"Come again?"
I paused, uncertain of how extensive George's knowledge with regard to the birds and bees might be.
"They exist only to make other lunar moths."
He seemed satisfied with that explanation, and came to the point of his errand. He brandished the newspaper, and I saw that the Daily Harbinger had outdone itself. The headline was larger than usual, and Stoker's name had been spelt out in all its formality, including his honorific.
"Bollocking hell," I muttered, as I hurried in the direction of the Belvedere.
The first order of business was to show the article to Stoker, and whether the inevitable display of temper that would follow. But as I handed over the newspaper and braced myself, he merely sat quite still and read for some minutes. When he finished, he folded the newspaper neatly and laid it aside.
"We knew it was coming,"
was all that he said. He walked out of the Belvedere, and I trotted after, following him to a broad sward of lawn, where he set to work on his latest project,
restoring a Montgolfier balloon, vibrant blue and spangled with the golden emblems of Bourbon kings. It had been commissioned by Louis XVI after several other successful flights had persuaded him of the promising potential of manned flight. It was not to be. Revolution intervened, and the royalist balloon had been abandoned before it had ever flown. The king had lost his head, and the balloon had been sold to a Rosmoran earl who had been passing through Paris during the Terror. It had remained at the Belvedere ever since, the wicker gondola providing a commodious bed for the dogs. But Stoker had other ideas, and he had taken to tinkering with the thing, even managing to launch it for a memorable flight above the kitchen garden that had caused the scullery maid to shriek and hide in the coal cellar for the better part of a day. His lordship was particularly enthralled with the project, giving Stoker carte blanche to order whatever supplies and materials he required for its reclamation. As I stood in silence, Stoker busied himself sorting various ropes and lines, his time in both the Navy and a travelling circus standing him in good stead as he knotted and arranged the rigging. Spread onto the frost-withered grass, the brilliant azure of the balloon was shown to splendid effect. The later Montgolfier balloons had been larger and grander, but I preferred this smaller version of the Aerostar Réveillon. "You're making quite good progress," I told Stoker by way of greeting. "Now, if you could persuade Bettany to stop using the gondola as her dog basket, you might offer balloon rides for tuppence each." He quirked a brow, but did not look up from his stitching.
"In point of fact, I have already spoken to his lordship about using it as a means of illustrating the properties of flight when the museum opens. For instance..."
He launched into a highly technical explanation of lift and the relative density of heated air and heaven knows what else. He broke off mid-sentence.
"You are not listening."
"Of course I'm not," I agreed. "I am thinking about our pursuer last night and the article in the Harbinger this morning." His gaze sharpened.
"You believe they are connected?"
"I haven't the faintest idea," I told him truthfully. "But there are half a dozen possibilities as to the identity of our miscreant. We cannot possibly examine them all ourselves, so we must have the most current information as to the state of the investigation. We must discover who might be connected with this case, and also interested in our movements and whereabouts. And since you have now been exposed as connected to this scandal, time is of the essence. The sooner we tear the mask from the face of this mystery, the sooner we can restore your name." I had expected my overblown prose to raise a smile, but he gave not even the merest twitch of the lips in reply. After a moment, he nodded.
"I suppose you are right. You mean to consult Mornaday?"
"He is our best option for information," I said mildly. "He is fond of me."
"He hates me," Stoker countered. "That might be enough to stopper his tongue."
"I think you underestimate my charms." We presented ourselves at Scotland Yard and were swiftly shown to Sir Hugo's office, where we were received by Inspector Mornaday, a waggish fellow with handsome hands and merry brown eyes.
"Well, 'tis always a pleasure to see you, Miss Speedwell, and that's the truth. I wish I could say the same for your pet wolf,"
he said with a glance to Stoker. "Stoker, do stop looming. You're alarming Mornaday." Mornaday and I exchanged a grin as Stoker gave a low growl. He and Mornaday frequently brought out the worst in one another, but the inspector was clearly in too exalted a mood to be cowed by Stoker's intimidation. That his high spirits were due to Sir Hugo's absence was all too apparent. He lounged behind his superior's desk with his booted feet resting atop, hands laced behind his head. He had leapt to his feet upon our arrival, but I waved him back. He was enjoying himself far too much for me to let good manners intrude upon his pleasure.
"What service may I perform for you, my glorious Miss Speedwell?"
he asked with a waggle of his brows. Mornaday's eyebrows were a gift of nature, well-shaped and more expressive than the rest of his features combined. He used them to great effect, conveying interest, curiosity, scepticism, and credibility with equal skill. With me, he frequently used them to indicate passionate flirtation. How sincere he was, I had yet to determine, but the question did not keep me wakeful at night. "We have come to discuss the disappearance of John de Morgan," I replied promptly. He shook his head.
"I am afraid your timing is unfortunate. His superiority is home abed with a nasty catarrh,"
he told us with an air of satisfaction. I resisted the urge to look at Stoker. We had agreed to proceed with Mornaday as if we were unaware of Sir Hugo's indisposition. Mornaday loved nothing more than feeling as if he knew more than other people, and this seemed an innocuous way to get into his good graces. "How unfeeling you are," I remarked. "Sir Hugo is, for all his faults, a man of good principles and your mentor. I am surprised to find you taking pleasure in his ill health." I gave him a repressive glance, and he put a hand to his heart.
"Pleasure? Nothing could be further from the truth," he said,
but his lips twitched. Stoker chose that moment to ease himself onto one of the small chairs Sir Hugo kept for visitors. The writing desk was a slender Regency affair, and the matching chairs were designed for elegance rather than substance. It was only after my third or fourth interrogation that I realized they had also been selected for maximum discomfort, no doubt to encourage his visitors to keep their visits brief and their answers truthful. The chair gave a little groan of protest at Stoker's considerable weight, and Mornaday shot him a worried glance.
"Steady, old man. I shouldn't like to explain to Sir Hugo how his chair ended up a pile of splinters." "Because you aren't actually supposed to be in here," Stoker hazarded.
Mornaday looked uncomfortable.
"Well, that is a matter of debate. Sir Hugo did ask me to conduct business as usual."
"With your boots on his desk and sipping his best single malt?" I asked sweetly. Without a word, Mornaday poured a measure of whiskey for me, sliding the bottle and a glass to Stoker as an afterthought.
"For your silence," he said thinly. "Now what do you want?"
"We have questions about the Tiverton expedition, specifically about the disappearance of John de Morgan, the expedition photographer."
"The expedition thief, you mean?"
he corrected. I inclined my head, and Stoker said nothing, sipping deeply from his glass. Mornaday rubbed his chin thoughtfully. Like Stoker, he eschewed facial hair. Stoker had shaven off his beard during our first investigation, and left it off as a matter of habit. Mornaday, I suspected, shaved closely in order to flaunt the rather adorable cleft in his chin.
"Ordinarily, the investigation would not fall under the aegis of Special Branch,"
Mornaday began, imitating Sir Hugo's plummy tones.
"But in this case, the stature of Sir Leicester Tiverton, as well as other considerations, means that reports have been made to this office."
"What other considerations?" I asked quickly. He gave a sharp shake of the head.
"That is not for me to say."
I suppressed a sigh. "Very well. What do your reports say?" He tipped his head in recollection.
"Almost nothing. The Tiverton expedition was enjoying its most successful season in Egypt, having secured the tomb of a previously undiscovered princess of the 18th dynasty. Unfortunately, they were beset by illness and accident, as well as the death of the expedition director, a Mr. Jonas Fowler. Fowler's death was not unexpected. He had a well-known heart condition. But the timing of his demise only added to the sensationalist stories, and rumours began to circulate of a curse placed upon the expedition by the restless spirit of the disturbed princess."
"Horse feathers,"
Stoker said succinctly. Mornaday shrugged.
"I am merely repeating what the reports say.
Once the suspicion of a curse took root, every incident or accident, no matter how mundane, was ascribed to its malign influence. The last victim was John de Morgan, who fell ill but recovered his strength enough to leave the dig abruptly with his wife Caroline. At the same time de Morgan left, a priceless diadem belonging to the princess's cache of grave goods went missing.
"And you are convinced de Morgan took it?"
Stoker asked. Mornaday shrugged.
"What other conclusion is there?"
"Then what about this business of his disappearance?" I asked.
"I can give you a dozen reasons, but the likeliest is to be found in the person of his wife. According to rumour, their relationship was a tempestuous one, demonstrably affectionate in good times, loudly disruptive in less good times."
"So you believe he took the diadem with an eye to financing his escape from his marriage?" I supplied.
"His marriage, a job to which he was unsuited, England, take your pick. De Morgan has been unsuccessful at most of his ventures. He has no capital of his own, and has been dependent upon the generosity of others to supply him with opportunities. This was, finally, a chance for him to be his own master and rid himself of a wife who had, by some accounts, possibly become a millstone."
"Whose accounts?"
Stoker asked in a quiet voice. Mornaday roused himself to look at Stoker.
"Come again?"
"Whose accounts? You say Mrs. de Morgan was a millstone around her husband's neck. Someone must have suggested it to the police. I doubt you'd have got there on your own."
Mornaday spread his hands.
"It was corroborated by several members of the Tiverton expedition. De Morgan had a temper, and apparently Mrs. de Morgan gave as good as she got."
"Then why take her with him?" I asked swiftly. "If de Morgan stole the diadem to underwrite his flight, why not leave his wife in Egypt?"
"What sort of blackguard would leave his unprotected wife in a filthy foreign land?"
Mornaday countered.
"Egypt,"
Stoker pointed out acidly,
"is not filthy. It was once the cradle of civilization. I would suggest you read a book, but I am not entirely certain of your ability to do so."
Mornaday dropped his feet to the ground, half rising from his chair. Stoker did the same, and I hastened to intervene.
"Boys," I said sharply, "there will be no brawling with your shirts on. Kindly remove your upper garments and give them into my keeping."
Both men turned to look at me, wearing identical expressions of astonishment. Mornaday spoke first.
"I beg your pardon?"
I adopted my best nanny tone, one that I had used with excellent results to bring unruly suitors to heel.
"You cannot strike an opponent properly while hampered by a tight coat," I pointed out, "or a fitted waistcoat, and white does show the blood so badly, the shirt must come off as well."
I put out my hands.
"Come on then, shirts off, both of you. Shall you fight to first blood or unconsciousness? I always think first blood is a little lacking. Let's go until one of you is entirely senseless, shall we?"
They exchanged sheepish glances and backed down, resuming their chairs and taking up their whiskey glasses once more. I looked from one to the other.
"No brawling, then? How very disappointing. Where were we?"
"The de Morgan disappearance,"
Mornaday said promptly.
"For whatever reason, de Morgan chose to return to England with his wife. They had a bad channel crossing, and he fell ill again with the same complaint that had troubled him in Egypt. Mrs. de Morgan took her husband to lodgings in Dover, a small private hotel where the expedition had stayed on their way out to Egypt. Once there, they registered and took separate rooms. De Morgan did not wish to be disturbed, and his wife slept heavily. The next morning, she awoke to find no trace of her husband, or the room which he had been assigned, or any of his effects. We have tracked his departure on the steamer out of Alexandria with his wife, but after that all signs of him are lost."
"You mean he might never have crossed the channel at all?" I said.
Mornaday nodded.
"The trail simply vanishes.
We know Mrs. De Morgan claims he crossed the channel with her, but there is no proof. He might have boarded a ship out of Marseille or Cherbourg for anywhere in the world, taking the Tiverton diadem with him. The Dover police inspector made such a blunder of questioning her that she went into hysterics and refused to answer any more questions beyond saying that she had told the truth. Her husband had come with her as far as Dover and then vanished in the night. We have pursued every possible avenue of investigation, but we have nothing. Without further evidence, we are left to conjecture, and Special Branch have more important things to worry about than one stolen bit of jewellery and a cast-off wife. He added, a trifle pompously.
Why would Mrs. De Morgan make up such a fantastical story?
Stoker asked. He drained his whiskey as he waited for the reply. His knuckles were white upon the glass, and I knew that for all his outward calm, he was still tamping down the embers of his temper.
Sir Hugo thinks she is colluding with her husband, that the stories of their quarrels were exaggerated, and that she means to slip quietly away and join him when the furor has died down.
He paused, an unholy gleam lighting his brown eyes.
For my part, I believe De Morgan has absconded on his own. I think he left her in France, and that Mrs. De Morgan has spun this fanciful tale in order to avoid another scandal with herself in the role of abandoned wife.
He spoke the last words as if tasting them, and his expression was one of cold satisfaction as he casually laid his hand on the newspaper on his desk, the latest edition of the Daily Harbinger. Stoker's mouth curved into a mirthless smile.
"You rotten little bastard!"
I leapt up before he could finish the sentence, gripping his coattails in both fists.
"Stoker, that is quite enough. Sit down,"
I ordered. I put up a hand, gesturing for Mornaday, who had risen to his feet in a defensive posture, to resume his chair as well. "So you are acquainted with Mrs. De Morgan's marital history," I said, keeping a weather eye upon Stoker.
"I am," Mornaday said with relish, "and quite a history it is."
I gave him a cold look. "Mornaday, bear baiting has been illegal for more than 50 years, and it requires a special stick," I told him. "Behave yourself." He had the grace to look abashed.
"All right, then. Yes, we know that Caroline De Morgan once featured at the heart of a society scandal when she sued her first husband, the Honourable Revelstoke Templeton Vane, for divorce on the grounds of cruelty and desertion. With the tempestuous nature of her second marriage, it is possible that Mrs. De Morgan has once again been abandoned and that she finds this difficult to accept."
"You really think she is lying in order to hide the fact that she has been cast off by her husband?" I finished.
"It is as likely an explanation as her partnering with him in order to steal the diadem. It depends entirely on the character of Mrs. De Morgan," he said, turning a thoughtful eye to Stoker. "John De Morgan left Egypt in the company of his wife and has not been seen since. Perhaps she killed him,"
Mornaday said flatly. I sucked in a sharp breath, and he went on in a conversational tone.
"After all, it wouldn't be the first time she left a man for dead."
The glass made no sound as it flew past Mornaday's head, but it shattered on the wall with the reverberating report of a gunshot. Mornaday leapt to his feet as the door was flung open.
"Mornaday! What the devil is the matter with you, man? This is no place for brawls, and is that spirits I smell?"
The man in the doorway was average in every possible way. Average height, average build, average colouring. Only his eyes, piercing and cold, were remarkable. Mornaday swallowed tightly.
"Inspector Archibond, I did not realise you were in the building."
Inspector Archibond's gaze swept from the whiskey-dampened wall to the puddle on the floor.
"I should think not. Clear up this mess and then get down to the mortuary. I've just had a note from Sir Hugo, and he shall be away until the end of the week at least. I am to keep an eye upon his open cases until his return."
His posture was ramrod straight,
but he managed to raise himself a little more stiffly.
"Do you have official police business? Might I be of assistance?"
he inquired, in a voice that was anything but solicitous.
"They were leaving,"
Mornaday said swiftly. Stoker and I rose and slipped away, just as Inspector Archibond began to lecture Mornaday upon the evils of drink. Once upon the pavement, Stoker paused, his eyes skimming over the assortment of folk bent upon their daily activities. After a moment, he narrowed his gaze to a woman in rusty black standing upon a soapbox and hectoring a few woebegone-looking fellows. Stoker scribbled something into his pocket notebook, tore out the page and handed it to the woman with a pound note. She bobbed a thank you, bonnet plume waving, and Stoker and I turned away.
"What was that?" "A subscription for Mornaday from the Temperance League of Greater London. I told her he was a disordered soul in need of saving from the degradation of drink."
He grinned, a shadow of his usual cheerful self, and we walked along in silence for some minutes, until Stoker stopped, not turning to look at me.
"You haven't asked about her. Not really."
"I shall not," I promised him. "When you want to tell me, you will." Still, he did not look at me, but he reached out and brushed a fingertip over my hand. It was a tiny thing, that gesture, but the whole world was contained within it. Gratitude, partnership, understanding. I had taken lovers around the world, more than a score of them at last count. But Stoker was the nearest thing I had ever known to an actual partner, and I knew better than to ask him for what he could not give. "We never told him about being followed last night," I began. Stoker shrugged.
"We are just as likely to solve the matter as he is. If we were followed once, we will most likely be again. We must be watchful for her, and lay a better trap."
"Perhaps. At least we know they have exhausted all possibilities. They have given up on finding De Morgan. So long as we are prepared to stick it out, we can hardly do worse than the professionals."
"Where next?"
Stoker asked, as we came to a crossroads. I considered our options. "I think it is time to meet a millionaire," I told him with a broad smile. "We are calling upon Horace Steele." Chapter 8. As befitted an American millionaire with a penchant for theatricality, Horace Steele had booked himself and his son into the Allerdale Hotel, the most expensive lodging in London. Designed to mimic the Queen's retreat at Balmoral Castle, the hotel was a neo-Gothic Scottish monstrosity complete with tartan carpets and waiters imported from the Highlands. But the food was incomparable, and the modern amenities second to none. We presented our cards to a passing porter and settled into the plaid lobby to await Mr. Steele's pleasure. But to my delighted surprise, we were summoned immediately. The porter escorted us into the hydraulic lift, and we were whisked up to the Empress Suite on the 7th floor.
"Mr. Steele is most particular,"
the porter observed. I narrowed my eyes at him, and he grinned.
"The accent was too much, wasn't it?"
he asked. "A trifle," I said thinly. "I presume you are not really Scottish?"
"Cockney, born and bred," he said with a nod. "But I needed the work and they'll only hire haggis eaters."
Stoker snorted, and I pressed a coin into the fellow's hand. "Just mind your R's and you will do quite nicely," I advised. He bowed us into the suite, and I was pleased to see that here the decorators had used a modicum of restraint. The carpet was one of the more subdued tartans, and the upholstered furniture was elegantly finished in bottle-green velvet. Prints of Highland scenes had been scattered about, and china bowls of heather added touches of soft purple. Above the mantel hung a picture of an indifferent deerhound looking down his nose. A fire was crackling merrily upon the hearth, and two armchairs of brown leather had been drawn near to its warmth. The whiskey decanter and soda siphon were near at hand, as were the day's newspapers. The two men who occupied the chairs rose.